Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 78 of A Life in Ruins podcast, where we investigate the careers of those living a life in ruins. I am your host, Connor Johnen, and I will not be joined by my co-hosts, David Howe and Carlton Gover. So this episode is going to be a little different than normal without David and Carlton participating. I continue our conversation with Dr. Brian Schroeder, who was originally on episode 15. Dr. Schroeder told us about his roots in Wyoming archaeology and also an insane story about a mummy. If you haven't listened to episode 15, I highly recommend it. We did not get to discuss other avenues of Dr. Schroeder's research at the Center for Big Ben Studies at Solrus State University, and this episode picks up there. And just so a heads up, this episode was recorded in the summer of 2020. Enjoy. So, Dr. Schroeder, how are you doing on this lovely May day?
I'm doing well. It's incredibly warm here and just ready to chat.
So you still have fieldwork that's ongoing because you're funded through this field season, right?
We have kind of a different situation than I think a lot of people do. Since we have so much private land, if we don't really have, and the weather's always hot, we don't really have seasons to go do field work. So we can kind of just go whenever we want. And we have kind of open access to a couple of these large ranches. And we've been going out and recording some sites that we've known about, but just haven't had time to do anything with during quarantine. And they're pretty involved sites. So they've been kind of, people have known about them for a long time, but they've been kind of neglected because they're pretty complex Pueblo type sites. They have architecture on them and stuff. So they kind of outliers down here. So they've just, people have known about them, but just haven't gone for them. So we excavated at one of them. We just did a little bit of testing because there was some bone that was eroding out that I thought might be bison bone. And so we went and got that, and it actually turned out to be a horse. Still neat, but not bison. And it's on a really cool, really late village period site. There's daub and post molds and structures there, but nobody's ever excavated the site, and it's huge. There's an incredibly rich assortment of pottery, and there's indigenous metalworking. We found a bronze metal point over this break. So it's a really late period site. It's got horse. Looks like they were butchering horses. So
interesting.
Pretty neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other one was kind of the same thing, but earlier. It's got Hornada Mogollon ceramics on it, and it's this real neat black and red ware, and there was a lot of it there, and we just don't find... We find a little bit of painted pottery off the Rio Grande, but not that much, and this one, this site had a ton of pottery on it, so the landowner's known about it for a while, so we went out and recorded it. It's really cool. It was... So freaking hot, though.
Oh, yeah.
The dog brought our dogs out, and the dogs went and just laid in the disgusting backwater of the Rio Grande.
That's awful. And it's, you're not even in, like, the height of your one season hotness, right? So you're still
right.
Early
in Yeah. We're not even in the hot part yet. No.
The hot part of the hot season.
Nope. Yeah, it was, it's, we're in the shoulder hot season.
So have you excavated the kind of sites with these Pueblo architectural sites before? Because, you know, it's interesting. Alpine just did a project down in Durango this last year. And to excavate these sites, it's a whole nother kind of beast in and of itself, kind of the way you approach that.
No, I haven't. And actually, nobody really has. I mean, there's been a little bit of work, but there's a series of kind of, it's an archaeological district. And there's a lot of debate whether it's related to the Jornada Mogollon groups up in kind of the El Paso area, or if it's like Pacame outlier groups. There was a lot of work in the 40s by first pioneering archaeologist down in this part of West Texas, J. Charles Kelly. And he did a lot. And then he went further down into Mexico and did it even more. And yeah, nobody's really gone out and done anything with them. And they're freaking cool. I mean, coming from a hunter-gatherer background, they're like decidedly complex sites. And I get a little bit intimidated by just the amount of stuff.
Oh yeah.
And it's kind of hard to know where to start. I don't know what your perception of them is, but like one of the things is the amount of pottery is just absolutely insane. And it's neat, but you kind of get to a point where it's like, man, what do you do with all this pottery? So just making sure you have like really good collection and sample strategies. But no, we haven't excavated any. That's kind of, as I transition into the director at the center, that's one of the things we're going to focus on, is re-engaging excavations at these sites to see what's there, because they're in pretty bad shape too. So
oh, no.
I will excavate one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was just
they're
weird.
They're all on private land too. So they're,
I was going to say, it's kind of weird. It's just when you excavate them, I've never, you know, it's this wild process of digging down to where you get to the architectural layers, and then you build grids off of that. But these grids are never like straight square one by ones or whatever, because most of these things are circular. So then it's like this fact finding mission to, you know, find these, all these architecture stuff. And I was, you know, I was like you, I was extremely intimidated, and I wasn't even like actively working in there. It's just like, how do you approach something so complex? And as you mentioned, with as much artifacts that come out of these things, it's insane.
And you get super deep, super quick. And, and what do you do with, yeah, there's a lot of different complexity there, but that's kind of fun, I think, to kind of step outside the boundary.
What, you don't want to dig like sterile one by ones in Western Wyoming? Come on.
I did that. But now I want to dig penthouses when it's 105 degrees on the Rio Grande.
and dogs are actively melting into the landscape around you.
Melting into the skunky Rio backwater of the Rio Grande.
Do you have any kind of sort of updates on kind of the stuff we talked about in episode 15 about like the human remains, or is that still in kind of the same sort of limbo as it was before?
Well, we finished a document and we put it into press, and we got soundly rejected by the journal, which I will remain nameless. And we resubmitted to a different journal, and we resubmitted in the end of March. I think that was the exact worst time to submit any paper to publication, and we haven't heard anything. So haven't heard anything else as far as like getting it out into the world. But as far as results, no, I haven't really chased anything super new since I spoke with you last time.
It's been interesting because I know you well enough to know that you started out in archaeology, you know, Eastern Wyoming, doing CRM kind of stuff and working in an academic context as well. But it seems like you have got yourself into a ton of different types of research, you know, as a part of working for the Center for Big Bend Studies. Are you enjoying that?
Yeah, I would say that I have become much more a generalist lately. And that's sort of by design. I got done with my dissertation and felt, I don't think I really felt burned out, but I just felt like I would know more than I did. I sort of felt like you go through this arc as a career where your undergrad, I felt like I was brilliant, and then master's, that started to shake, and then PhD, I didn't feel smarter. I actually felt like I knew way less. So I didn't really feel like I specialized in anything. So, but I feel like I had a lot of base knowledge and a lot of stuff. So I kind of went forward with that. And I would say more than anything, my trajectory forward is about collaboration, because I know that, like, where I am now, I'm sure you, there's the same thing in Wyoming and Colorado. I know there is, and I'm sure you experience that as well. There's a series of professionals that have grown up there, and they have kind of a stake to the research there. And I think in many senses, they kind of know the culture history really well, and they know the sites, and they know the literature. And that's where I am now. I'm the new person coming into a world like that. And rather than, I don't know anything that a lot of people down here that have devoted their lives to it don't know. So more than anything, I've collaborated, and I guess I use what I've learned from getting my doctorate to find maybe the holes that other people have overlooked. So that's sort of how I've become a generalist. I think that the smartest thing that anybody can do is say that you don't know. And my incredible, weird, eclectic research focus now is because I've said, I don't know, but I'm going to ask a lot of questions. And that's gotten me where to I was. But I mean, at my dissertation events, my big comment was, this dissertation's good, but it's too focused on one region, and you're going to box yourself into a corner, and you're not going to work there in 5 years. And at that time, I was so offended by that. I was pissed. I'm like, what do they know? I've worked in Wyoming my entire life. That's where my research is. That's where I'm going to be. And pretty upset about that. And then, you know, fast forward to now, 5 years later, and I'm digging village period sites on the border of Mexico. So I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I think if you can stay open enough and kind of know where to ask the right questions, I think that that's really important. I feel like there needs to be more generalists. So I guess that eclectic nature is kind of what I'd like to see more people do.
Yeah. I mean, it probably involves a lot more reading and researching, because you have to build that background knowledge in a variety of different subjects. But if you're willing to put in that time, it seems like that can only benefit you. You get to learn so much more and be a more well-rounded archaeologist by doing that.
Yeah, it also knows, like, the dry cave where, you know, most of these mummies came out of that we talked about last time. And I mean, I've never really had free access to a site that cool. I mean, this is a site that if it was on public land, it'd have huge grades over it, and you'd have to, like, schedule visitation rights and, I mean, hours, and you'd be, you know, a ranger would take you down there. I mean, it's a really complex ecosystem, and the landowner is doing a really good job of taking care of it. But at the same time, we have totally uncontrolled access to it. But you go down to a site like that, and you know, just as an researcher, yeah, I think anybody would know, in, you know, that has research at mind, that there is so much more that we can learn from this cave than the archaeology. So I walked into it the first day kind of thinking, I mean, I'm interested in this, like, Holocene record of what's happening here, but clearly there's much, much more going on than that that's interesting to more people. So really, all of my work at that one site in particular kind of stemmed from making sure I talked to as many specialists in their field as possible, and got rejected by some, and some came out and helped me. A lot of people, I think, probably thought, well, who's this crazy person?
Hey, I got this deep cave. Can you help me on this something?
Yeah, I got this really cool cave. We could do a lot on it. Like, yeah, okay, sure.
in this kind of approach, taking this bigger approach, is this where you found the ground sloth that you had sent me that paper on and at least talked to me about?
Yeah, so the ground sloth. So what happened was I was trying to find, I mean, the cave is incredibly looted. It's got this huge main chamber and it's just industrial. It looks like people just, I mean, they vacuumed it for at least 100 years. And so what I wanted to do was preserve the deposits that were left. So I actually made a gear haul line to get 100-pound cattle mats into the cave. And we got them up into the cave and we lined the cave floor with them. So when we walked across it, we didn't mess any of the deposits up. And I wanted to get into the back. There's these two back cave or these two back shafts. They go about 30 meters off of the main chamber. They actually go further than that, but then they get really into spider territory.
Big, big
habitat, Texas which spider. Is not my jam. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And they get really into some pretty gnarly spiders that made one student just break down into tears. And I was like, can't help you. Sorry. there's nothing I can do to help you. That's a bummer for you. So I wanted to preserve those deposits, but I also wanted to map it and use ground-based LiDAR, but I wanted to tie it into the front excavations that I was doing. So I put the mats in, I crawled in there, and I was going to set all my datums in concrete because I just thought it's a significant enough site that, you know, we'll come back to that, or somebody will come back to it, and I want them to be able to tie into what I did. Mm-hmm. And so I set the datums in concrete, and there was a little bit of cave debris there. I didn't think there'd be any deposits there. So I thought, you know, there'd be nothing. So there's like right on the edge of the cave and I brushed it off and I collected it and screened it. But when I was hitting the bottom of it, my rock hammer kind of bounced back. And I was like, well, that's weird. It was really, really just spongy and dense. Like that is not what you expect to find at the bottom of a cave deposit. And I opened it up and took a look at it. And it was just this mat of fiber, like really flat mat of fiber. And I thought, you know, this is great. This will give me, and it was right on top of bedrock. And I was like, this is great. This will give me a date of, you know, how this deposit is filled. So I'll have, you know, at least know how old the back of this cave is and, you know, the deposits I'm working in are. Mm-hmm. And I took it out and took a piece of the top and bottom and dated it and sent out to Direct AMS and I got the dates back. And they sent the dates on like a Saturday night and like, it was really late. It was like 11 o'clock at night out here in Texas. So I guess it was only 9 o'clock there, but in Washington, but it was kind of a weird time to receive a radiocarbon date. And I saw it and I thought it said 1099. And I was like, oh man, that's a real bummer. The only deposits in that back chamber will be younger than late archaic. So what a bummer. And I went down and was kind of doing something else and got, I was like, wait a second, did that say 10,999? I looked at the dates again and it was 10,999. And I thought, wait, what does that mean? what does that come out to? And what is that calibrated? So I started calibrating dates at like midnight on a Saturday. And one was 10,099 uncalibrated. And the other was 11,024. And are those Clovis? Is that Clovis? And it would be a very early Clovis age date, but it kind of falls in there when you calibrate it. And then I started thinking, okay, what is that? What did I just date? I get this really dense packed fiber mat. So I started asking a lot of the folks that research paleo Indians, like, so I'm up there at the SAAs. I'm talking about this potential Clovis Age deposit in this cave. What are all you guys snickering about in the audience? What do you guys tell me that I'm wrong about that I totally overlooked? And they resoundingly said, we'd ask you why it wasn't sloth poop. Like, huh. Okay. Well, who researched sloth poop? So there's an incredible researcher. There is one guy, well, there might be more guys, but there is there is a guy that is, he's just a tremendous human. He's a fantastic guy. Dr. Jim Mead at the Mammoth Museum in Hot Springs, South Dakota. And I called him up and he said, yeah, sure, send it. And I sent it to him. And he said, yeah, it looks like sloth poop. There's not enough to make it a definitive ID. And he started explaining to me that it's not a bolus that, you know, sloth usually have, kind of like a horse apple. It's a little bit more platy than that, but it's a horse apple, essentially, for our purposes here. And he said, you know, what you have is more of a barnyard situation. I immediately knew that I liked it. So he said, you know, if you can find a bolus, tell me. And way back in the other shaft, so there's two shafts that go off of this main chamber. There was way back up in there, the first time I was in there, there was a piece of poop that looks, I just thought it was donkey shit. I mean, I really, really did. I mean, never mind that you have to crawl on your hands and knees to get back there, but yeah, I just didn't think anything of it. And as soon as he said, you know, there should be these bolus, they're rounder, and I think, oh my God, I know exactly where one is. So I drove out there and got it and I sent it to him. And he said, this looks right. I'll radiocarbon date it. And he radiocarbon dated and it came out 31,000 BP. Holy shit.
Yeah, that pushes it back a little bit.
31,000 year old. Yeah. So there's a late Pleistocene Holocene transition piece. And then there is 31,000 year old piece on the surface. And that's absolutely amazing. And anybody would have walked by. You walk right by this and it looks exactly like, you know, something you see out in the field. It didn't look, you know, 31,000 years old. And so he decided to come out, and he came out, and there's a really good local public radio station that I reached out to him, you know, just in case, you know, there was more to it than that. And we went out there, and I have to tell you, this expedition was like one of the most amazing expeditions ever. I never talked to Dr. Mead on the phone ever. And I got random sporadic emails about potentially coming out. And then he literally texted me from the gas station and said, hey, I'm in Marfa, the next town over. Do you want to meet and go down there? Like, wait, you drove from South Dakota?
That's not a small feat.
we met up with this reporter, and the reporter was sleeping in a tent in some of his friend's house in town. He wasn't in the house. He was in a tent. And he had some beer and some peanut butter. And Mead had beef jerky and I think peanut butter and a bottle of wine. And these guys were ready to go down and do a sloth dung expedition on the border of Mexico. You know, we could buy food. There are grocery stores and we could do this a touch more civilized.
It's West Texas is basically like the old West, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. Beef jerky, peanut butter, and your dreams. just a research, an interest in research. So we all went down there and we dug a small trench where I found the 13,000 year old dung. Mm-hmm. And I somehow placed the datum on the only remnant of sloth dung, 13,000 year old sloth dung in there. Like somehow I perfectly hit the only piece to set this off. And just wow, by placing a datum. And where we found the 31,000 year old stuff, we went there and we found, Jim found tons. I mean, there is so much sloth shit there, and it's everywhere.
Huh.
So I really just found what had been kicked up to the surface. And the pack rat midden is also, so what he thinks is it's probably a 29,000 year old pack rat midden that has 31,000 year old sloth dung in it.
Wow.
And that wasn't looted.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty amazing. So you found the dung, and then you, subsequently did research on this because, you know, we can use dung, either human or non-human, to kind of understand diet, maybe environment. There's a lot of other stuff you can study. What kind of information did you learn about this?
So it's kind of interesting. There's not very many sloth dung caves or shelters in North America. I think there's like 12 total. So in and of itself, you're getting this dietary information on these, you know, late Pleistocene megafauna that you don't get anywhere else. So he wanted to do a whole bunch of stuff. He wanted to do DNA on the plant diet and stuff, but none of it preserved. So what we did is phytoliths to kind of reconstruct the Chihuahuan desert. And that's been kind of a big debate down here, is when some of the diagnostic plants of the Chihuahuan desert kind of took root here, I guess, if I can use that. He was really looking for that. And I got to admit, that's totally his research. I was much more interested in that being cloves-aged fiber bed. But that being said, you also do get a construction of the end of the Pleistocene as far as what environment humans would be kind of moving into. So from that standpoint, it was really interesting. And what he found is that it was a pinyon juniper upland that the 31,000-year-old sloth was living in. And that plant community kind of receded a little bit and started getting some more of the diagnostic features of the Chihuahuan desert by about 13,000 years. And apparently we have one of the only records of creosote bush moving in at that time period. And there's been a lot of pack rat midden work down here, and it hasn't found creosote that early. So
interesting.
I think we have to do more. He doesn't think that's a contaminant. Yeah, he doesn't think that's a contaminant. So that might mean, you know, Clovis aged folks would have been moving into a landscape, at least in the Chihuahuan desert, that are early Paleo Indians would have been moving into a landscape that looked fairly similar to what it does now, pretty xeric. And that has implications. We don't have very many early Paleo Indian sites in this area. We haven't really done a big focused look on them, but that might explain whether or not here, because, yeah, I don't know. So
interesting. And I have to clarify, so this isn't the giant ground sloth that people are talking about, right? That is very famous for, you know, being big.
Yeah, so when I asked Dr. Mead about it, he told me it was the very small. It was the smallest of the ground North American ground sloths. There's three different genus. This one is the Shasta ground sloth. So this one is about the size of, as he put it, a small steer, which I think to us that don't study megafauna is a pretty big sloth.
So, yeah, absolutely.
I think he said that it's, 750 pounds on average. So that's a pretty big, ground critter.
Yeah, no joke. So no, that's super interesting, man. Like that's wild that you're able to do that collaboration kind of stuff coming from an archaeological base to kind of ask these questions and do this research. You know, I very much is like you said, it's you're like, what is this? How old is this? You know, it brings you to some interesting places.
Yeah. For me, it started with a very archaeologically focused question. And I think, I don't know. I mean, there might've been researchers that would have put it down, but to me it was like, well, that's cool. How many caves with ground sloth poop in them are there in North America? And that seems worthwhile. So
absolutely.
So what it essentially did too is it expanded the range for the Shasta ground sloth down this far in the Southwest. They're kind of known throughout the Southwest, and this extended them into this portion of Texas. So as he explained it to me, and he doesn't say that in the paper we just wrote, which might need clarification, but what he said to me that it is a South American animal originally, but this is the southernmost expression of a South American animal in North America, which is a little bit weird. to wrap your head around.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. And you guys didn't, at least not yet, you guys haven't found any human evidence directly associated with the sloth or in this kind of range between like 30,000 and 10 to 11,000 years.
No, we haven't. No, that's, and that's what's interesting for me is now that you know, for me, we know that there are deposits that are preserved in that cave that are the right age. And now I really haven't done much excavation there since this. So the potential is there now, you know, the deposit, the right age deposits are there. So I don't know that there's going to be any 13,000-year-old human occupation of that cave, but certainly the right aged stuff is there. So it's a real good place to look.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been interesting kind of talking with you just because we text randomly and be like, hey, I found this. Hey, I found this. It's been fun to kind of live vicariously through you. Another thing that you had mentioned to me is that that you've found some really early evidence of maize. It's, I don't know if it's in the same cave or a different area, but you're also finding like really early evidence of maize in these areas as well.
Yeah. So my research focus at this cave, it's called Spirit Eye Cave. My research focus on it was to just radiocarbon date a bunch of stuff because it was looted so much. So as part of that, I wanted to get as many of the collections back as I could. And we can't dig them, but my focus is trying to reconstruct the occupation of the cave as best we can with just radiocarbon dates alone. So just taking all these perishables artifacts in the collection and putting it back together. And one of the original landowners had a box of corn from the cave and brought it back to me. And I'd been finding a lot of corn in my stuff there too. And I got with some folks that specialize in studying maize, and they picked out, you know, I think I had 50 pieces. And yeah, I told them, you know, I'm not going to date all 50 pieces, but if you can sort of go through this assemblage and pick out the five cobs that you think kind of typify the range of variation in this assemblage, I'll date those and maybe we'll get a range of dates and, you know, we can go from there. And so I dated all that maize that the collectors and I collected from the cave. And I mean, you look at them and just, you know, hold them to your hand and look at them, they look like completely different types of maize. And I thought, you know, this is getting, you know, this will give me maize use out here. It's probably going to be really late. And, you know, I'll get some research going on different types of maize and stuff. And I sent them away, got the five dates, and statistically, they are the exact same radiocarbon date. I mean, they are all the exact same age, and they're about 2100 Cal BP, which is about 1400 years earlier than any other maize that's been dated from the region.
Wow.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, those village sites we were talking about earlier, those are supposed to be agriculturalists, and they're supposed to be, you know, post AD 1300. So all of a sudden you have maize at, you know, 100 BC, and that's much different than maize post AD 1300. So obviously the next step was, okay, so these came from a collection. So that's going to be a level of scrutiny that people are going to add to it, especially if you're going to push the maize data maize back in a region, you know, 1,000+ years.
Yeah, that's a big jump in archaeology.
That's not an insignificant leap. So I started dating all of the maize that we had got. We had dug a lot of shelters and we have maize from them, but it's just never been dated. So I started dating all of that, and about 2100 Cal BP is when the majority of dates come back now. So it's much easier to date a piece of late archaic maize from these shelters than it is a piece of when they're supposed to be actually doing agriculture. So
interesting.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're calling it maize, so that suggests it's not the wild cultigen that corn came from.
No, it's actually
domestic. It's actually the domesticated version.
These are cobs. It's not Tewasinte. Yeah, they're not big cobs, but they're cobs. It's maize.
Yeah, that's cool, man. That's super
What's
cool.
Interesting is the late archaic cobs. Yeah, they seem to be larger than the Puebloan ones, the late period stuff. So that's bizarre.
Because the theory is that, you know, as you intensify agriculture, your crop yield should get bigger through time, just because you should be getting better at it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you would hope so.
You hope it doesn't come back smaller every year, or yield smaller every year.
That is another period, just like, you know, ground sloth dung. It's not something that I'm super versed in, and I can tell you now that the transition, I know, I'm sure a lot of people know this, archaeologists know this, but we just have this intense fascination with maize. Because of that, there has been an amazing amount of research on the domestication of maize. And I would say more than anything that I'm sort of dipping a toe into in my new generalist career, maize is daunting. There is so much written. There's so much studied on it. And it's something I avoided, quite honestly, because it's not something I ever really thought I would research. But now that I'm in it, it's especially the early use is pretty fascinating chapter of human history.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the amount of science and the amount of technology that's put to use on studying these maize things is super interesting. You know, they do like you had talked about, like DNA with like sloth dung, but don't they do kind of DNA with maize nowadays to kind of track how it changes through time?
Yeah, I'm working with some researchers at the University of York, and they're doing the DNA on the cobs out here in West Texas to see if it relates to the Pacific Coast stuff or if it relates to Southwestern stuff. So there's kind of been two histories. There's been a use of it kind of going up the Sierra Madre Occidental into the Tucson Basin. And that's pretty definitively the earliest use as far as North America is concerned. But then there seems to be a second strain coming out of the Baja region.
Wow. That's wild, man.
we're in that kind of weird transition where it's not the earliest stuff by any means, but it's early, and it could either fit within those 2000 more Pacific focus kinds, or it could be some strain of Southwestern stuff.
Wow. Yeah. And I'll have to say that I think my knowledge of domestication and stuff is, you know, limited to Richard Adams' presentation on domestication and that kind of stuff. Just because, you know, that's, you know, going to CSU in Wyoming, it's not something that is wholly important to studying hunter-gatherers. it's not tip-top.
It's really not. But I mean, what's interesting, particularly about this, is these guys aren't agriculturalists. I mean, they're just not. They're practicing low-level food production. And there's all sorts of interesting social implications that they're probably not producing enough for seed stock. So they have to maintain contact with somebody that is producing enough surplus maize to actually have a stock of seed corn. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting. And are they growing it as kind of a, like has been argued with the Fremont groups in the Utah region? Are they growing it kind of in like micro niches where they have this like ancillary cultivation strategy where if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, they're still all in on hunter gathering. And so it doesn't directly affect their foraging so much. But I mean, it's what's really interesting down here is that we don't really know. I mean, does it lead to something like it does in the Tucson Basin and the Colorado Plateau, where you actually get groups that like start practicing, you know, pit house use and sort of kind of become something that looks basket maker? It's kind of a really interesting date to get back with all sorts of implications. And now that I have three sites that definitively have late archaic maize on it, which fit within what broadly in the Southwest is called the early agricultural period. I don't know. There's all sorts of really interesting implications for that.
So you had mentioned the Fremont, and they're like these folks who are really, really well studied really well understood, but they're well researched, and they kind of have these identifying markers that can say, hey, well, this is like, you know, we can guess this is Fremont or something like that. Is there some sort of group or culture or like set of artifacts in West Texas that resembles that? Or is it just not researched enough so you don't know at this point?
No, because the maize always got lumped with, anytime anybody found maize, they lumped it in with those late period sites that we were talking about earlier. So it's just, you know, that's like a post AD 1300 stuff thing. So nobody has really focused on that early use. So there's a completely untapped research potential, and it was thought to be pretty limited in distribution. And I mean, there's the three counties down here are essentially the size of Maryland, and there's been very little archaeology done in them. And without just talking with people, I know of 22 caves that have maize in them. And that's just from people who are willing to talk with me off of a couple of different ranches. So I think the use of early maize is way more prevalent down here. And I think more than anything, and this is total speculation, but I know that, you know, maize going across the crest of the Sierra Madre Occidental into the Tucson Basin is early. But to me, it seems like there should be another early wave going up the Rio Conchos into the Rio Grande. So it seems like water would be a much easier, you know, up riverways would be a much easier way for the early spread of maize. So I wouldn't be surprised that in the next 2 to 3 years that we're finding 3,000 to 4,000-year-old maize here.
Hmm. So I love talking with you about this stuff because you get excited about it. And I think you really explain things well. And it's super cool to hear about a doctor in archaeology who's taking all these different ventures and asking all these different questions. And I really applaud you for taking that route. And I think it's been fun as a friend to kind of hitchhike around for the stories. So it's I super want to thank you for, you know, coming and chat about me. And I hope that, you know, this becomes something as you discover this horse thing that's going to happen, you know, the butchering of horse. You know, I'm excited to see what your research is kind of and where it goes, man.
Me too. I'll gladly share it with you.
Well, thank you so much, Brian. I just wanted to, so this is a bonus episode for the APN members. So you APN members, I really hope you enjoyed this show. And I just interviewed Dr. Brian Schroeder on this APN members only bonus episode. So stay weird, San Diego.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.